Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 201. It's Monday, March 6th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, let's start up with an infectious disease story. This has perhaps a slight link to Ohio. This is happening in Kentucky, a potential measles outbreak. And there has been from the Columbus outbreak that was declared closed a number of weeks back. Actually, there's a case from Ohio that looks like it's spilled over into Kentucky, but this from CBS News. CDC says 20,000 people may have been exposed to measles at Asbury University Religious Revival. An estimated 20,000 people attended a large religious gathering in Kentucky on the same days as a resident who was infected and with measles last month, CDC said, with potential contacts who may have been exposed to the highly transmissible virus now spanning multiple states and countries. The case marks a third diagnosis in Kentucky over as many months, including another link to a recent large outbreak in Ohio. Nationwide, the CDC says a total of 3 measles cases have been reported in 2 jurisdictions this year. Asbury University said the person attended the religious services before developing symptoms of measles. However, the CDC said the person was contagious at the time they were on campus for February 17th and 18th. The measles virus is considered among the most highly transmissible diseases, with as many as 9 in 10 susceptible contacts of contagious cases catching the virus. For immunized people exposed to the virus, the vaccine is estimated to be around 97% effective. Well, the good news in that is students at Asbury University are required to have received the 2-dose MMR vaccine, which includes the measles vaccine. Of course, the bread and butter of infectious disease, particularly highly infectious diseases, is large gatherings. So hopefully won't see any cases, but yikes, this could be a super spreader event. It's possible. Okay, and more infectious disease news. This one related to microbial resistance. This from the Washington Post. CDC issues warning about rise in highly drug-resistant stomach bug. The CDC is warning clinicians and public health departments about a sharp rise in serious gastrointestinal infections caused by bacteria that are resistant to common antibiotics. Most people recover without treatment with antibiotics, but people who have weakened immune systems, including those with HIV, who are receiving chemotherapy, or can get a more serious illness. Severe shigellosis can spread into the blood, which can be life-threatening. Drug-resistant shigella infections are challenging to treat and easily transmissible, especially among vulnerable populations, said Nima Logan, a CDC medical officer. These superbug infections are a serious public health threat, and we want to ensure that providers are aware of the increasing potential for antibiotics to fail. Shigella causes an estimated 450,000 infections in the United States each year. In 2022, about 5% of Shigella infections reported to the CDC were caused by super-resistant strains, compared with none in 2015. Shigella bacteria spread rapidly and easily through direct person-to-person contact, including sexual contact. They also spread indirectly through contaminated food, water, and other routes. It takes just a small number of bacteria to make someone sick. And infected people can spread the germs to others for several weeks after their diarrhea ends. The CDC said it does not have recommendations for the best way to treat highly resistant Shigella infections. And of course, That's the problem. When you run out of drugs to treat it, you can get more deathly or disabling outcomes. Okay, next up, a follow-up on a continuing story, this from Associated Press. Toxic forever chemicals about to get their first U.S. limit. The Environmental Protection Agency is expected to propose restrictions on harmful forever chemicals in drinking water after finding they are dangerous in amounts so small as to be undetectable. But experts say removing them will cost billions, a burden that will fall hardest on small communities with few resources. Concerned about the chemicals' ability to weaken children's immune systems, the EPA last year said that PFAS could cause harm at levels much lower than previously understood. We, as a community of scientists and policymakers and regulators, really missed the boat early on, said Susan Piney, director of the Center for Environmental Genetics at the University of Cincinnati. There is also evidence that compounds are linked to low birth weight, kidney cancer, and a slew of other health problems. It is unclear what the EPA will now propose and how well it will protect people from those recently understood harms. For communities with the pollutants, it's not a cheap problem to solve. Nationally, it could cost roughly $38 billion to remove enough of the chemicals to meet a strict EPA rule limiting to where they can't be detected, according to an estimate prepared by engineering consultant Black & Veatch for the American Water Works Association and Industry Group. There will also be ongoing costs for filter material and testing. The good news, perhaps, is this. The consultant looked at federal and state results and estimated that 4 to 12% of water providers nationally will need to treat for PFAS due to the EPA rule. So that's bad enough, but at least it's not more widespread or majority of water. It's not universal, but they're saying that 4 to 12% of water providers nationally basically have detectable levels because they're really talking about bringing it down very low. Okay, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about firearm storage. This from Medical Express. Many firearm owners in the U.S. store at least one gun unlocked, fearing an emergency. Most firearm owners keep at least one firearm unlocked, with some viewing gun locks as an unnecessary obstacle to quick access in an emergency, according to a Rutgers study. But when they do lock their firearms, Rutgers researchers found that firearm owners are most likely to use gun safes. Despite evidence that securely stored firearms can help prevent firearm injury and death, the authors found 58% of firearm owners store at least one firearm unlocked and hidden, and 18% store at least one firearm unlocked and unhidden. Among those who store at least one firearm locked, gun safes are the most frequently used type of option. These findings highlight two key points, said Michael Anestis, executive director of the New Jersey Gun Violence Research Center at Rutgers, an associate professor at the Rutgers School of Public Health and the lead author of the study. First, it appears firearm owners prefer gun safes relative to cable locks and trigger locks. Most locking device distribution programs provide cable locks and trigger locks, so these programs might be mismatched to firearm owner preferences. Second, very few firearm owners use biometric locks, which could indicate that cost is an issue or that firearm owners do not trust the technology to work when needed. Among those who don't lock their firearms, the most common reasons were the belief that locks are unnecessary at almost 50%, and that locks will prevent quick access in emergency, 45%. On the other hand, firearm owners most frequently indicated that they would consider locking unlocked firearms to prevent access to a child, 49%, to prevent theft, 37%, and to prevent access by an adolescent or teenager, 37%. Given these results, it appears that increasing the access to secure firearm storage will require several things, Anestis says. First, to address motivation, we need to address disproportionate fears regarding the likelihood of armed home invasions. Similarly, we need to help the public better understand the risks associated with having firearms in the home, above and beyond the risk of unauthorized access by children. Second, we need to create more ready and equitable access to gun safes so that the available locking options align better with the preferences of firearm owners. And of course, this is a little unclear that to have the public better understand the risks associated with having firearms in the home. This is basically mostly related to suicide risk. There are more suicides by firearms than there are homicides. And actually, a gun owner is more likely to kill themselves than be killed by somebody else. So that is a risk that needs to be considered. Okay, well, next up, a mental health and healthcare story. This is from U.S. News and World Report. Study finds black people visit ER for mental health at highest rates. From 2018 to 2020, non-Hispanic black adults visited the emergency department for any mental health-related concern at nearly double the rate of the national average, according to the CDC. New research finds black adults are more likely to visit emergency departments when experiencing a mental health problem than white adults, but face longer delays and are less likely to be admitted to a hospital for treatment. Black adults had higher rates for emergency department visits compared with white and Hispanic adults across all categories of mental health disorders studied, including substance use disorders, anxiety disorders, mood disorders, and schizophrenia. Okay, next up, I have a story also on mental health, but this one pans out to a much larger perspective of politics and mental health, and women in particular. This from The Hill. At the intersection of politics and mental health, women are standing out. Mental health challenges have not been something politicians were comfortably airing until recently. That has shifted in the American national level, with Senator John Fetterman from Pennsylvania, as he drew praise across the spectrum for being open as he went into the hospital for depression recently. Around the world, we are opening a path into new territory around mental health and public life. It's a good thing because it encourages us to question stereotypes about leadership. As we do so, it also opens a door for the next generation of young women who are ready to step up and lead. The idea that a political leader must be, quote, strong or, quote, tough, traits typically attributed to men, is less popular than it used to be. And as leaders in the next generation encounter less of the old stigma around mental health as a barrier, it will lead to more humane policymaking and more authentic, open leadership. It will lead to a genuine shift in our global political culture for a better future together. The resignations of Nicola Sturgeon and Jacinda Ardern have also hit home as part of this shift. Both women, leaders of Scotland and New Zealand, were open as they stepped down recently. Both said they were processing the impact of governing during the COVID-19 pandemic. Sturgeon described the, quote, physical and mental impact on me. Meanwhile, Ardern talked about not having enough gas in the tank to carry on the job. There was some sexist response to Ardern's resignation. The BBC ran a headline asking, "Can women have it all?" But commenters expressed outrage and the broadcasters corrected the headline. Meanwhile, we are asking if enough is being done to keep brilliant young women in politics. That is a good question. Sturgeon talked about the brutality of modern political discourse. Political observers say there's a shift in how women leaders can be more open. And voters, too, are keen to see their political leaders do more about mental health. A recent survey of Gen Z voters in America by the organization Ignite showed the issue as a high priority at the ballot box. These were rare exceptions to the taboo around mental health and politics in the past. Sir Winston Churchill described long depressive episodes as visits by, quote, my black dog. Recent research now suggests he may have suffered from bipolar disorder. But historians continue to gloss over deep discussions of his symptoms. They prefer to focus on his legacy as though it were separate from the human who left it. Historians have long resisted combing too deep into President Abraham Lincoln's, quote, melancholy, even though it is now something some partly credit with giving him the tools to outlaw slavery. Most historians now agree that Lincoln suffered from clinical depression. Likewise, both Churchill and Lincoln were born to privilege, and they were both white men. Today's political leaders can be young women. They can be women of color, queer, Muslim women, trans women, and women living with disabilities. They can come from poverty. Moving such diverse women into every level of politics will change things, but it will take time and it will take dismantling outdated notions of what leadership looks like. This means embracing new narratives about what it means to be a political leader, including who is, quote, fit for office, and how addressing mental health in politics can actually lead to more authenticity in leadership. We also need to urgently address the mental health crisis plaguing young women today. As a leader of a young women's political empowerment organization, I have seen how mental health impacts young people, especially young women. This is an issue they care about, and it's an issue that directly impacts their political confidence, ambition, and desire to lead. In a 2020 survey conducted during COVID, we saw shocking mental health numbers. 65% of respondents felt unhappy or stressed. 73% felt constantly under strain. 53% lost sleep over too much worry. New research by the CDC released in February shows record levels of sadness in teen girls. Yes, those numbers are startling, but I don't see them as engendering despair. In fact, I see them as more of a reason to go out and engage more young women in a conversation about their agency and power. I want them to see these challenges as a part of a journey towards heroic achievements, a bit like Winston Churchill and Abraham Lincoln may have done generations earlier. I've met countless young women who cared about issues in their communities, but who fear political leadership. I introduced them to local, relatable political leaders. They talked together about how important it was to rewrite the rules. Then, those women grew more comfortable with the idea of running for office. As we see our politicians being more open about the challenges they face, young women will see themselves in leadership more often. I hope they will revel in this new territory and grow bolder, braver versions of our older selves. Yes, my friends, we should be run by human beings, not our ideas of what human beings are. And, in a little bit of a shift but somewhat related, I have a few stories here on about artificial intelligence and healthcare. So let's move to the non-human territory. Unfortunately, that's a lot of healthcare. This from The Hill. Majority in new poll would be uncomfortable with healthcare provider relying on AI. A majority of Americans in a new poll say they'd be uncomfortable with their healthcare provider relying on artificial intelligence as part of their medical care, and less than half think AI would lead to better health outcomes. A Pew Research poll found just 39% of U.S. adults say they feel comfortable with AI as part of their medical care in practices like screening, diagnosis, and treatment, while 60% would feel uncomfortable. A third of respondents think using AI would lead to worse health outcomes for patients, and 37% think using it wouldn't make a difference. Just 38% think the practice would lead to better health outcomes. Exactly three-quarters think the healthcare sector will move too fast towards AI technology before fully understanding the risk for patients, compared with just 23% who think providers will move too slowly, missing opportunities to improve patients' health. At the same time, a plurality of Americans think using AI in healthcare could reduce healthcare provider mistakes, with 40% saying AI could better the issue and 27% saying AI could actually up the number of errors. More than a third, that's 37%, think AI could worsen patients' healthcare record security, and more than half, or 57%, say using AI could worsen the personal nature of patient-provider relationships. And the FDA is getting involved in this. Next up from Stat News, the FDA plans to regulate far more AI tools as devices. The industry won't go down without a fight. Health tech companies are in a tizzy. After years of letting companies roll out software tools to guide patients' care with little oversight, the Food and Drug Administration is taking a tougher stance. In September, the FDA announced its intention to regulate many of these AI-powered clinical decision support tools as devices, which regulators say has always been their plan and within their purview. But the industry says it was blindsided by the move. In a fierce rebuttal, the Clinical Decision Support Coalition filed a petition against it. Well, you know, if the industry's against it, it's probably a good idea. And to round out our trifecta of AI stories, this from Medical Express. Infants outperform AI in common sense psychology. Infants outperform artificial intelligence in detecting what motivates other people's actions, finds a new study by a team of psychology and data science researchers. Its results, which highlights fundamental differences between cognition and computation, point to shortcomings in today's technologies and where improvements are needed for AI to more fully replicate human behavior. So being able to compute things really fast does not make you any at all resembling human behavior. In fact, infants can outperform AI in that regard, making common sense psychological conclusions. Okay, well, let's switch gears and do a series here on chronic diseases in the U.S. This first one from MedPage Today, alarming rise in colon cancer rates among younger people. Diagnosis of colorectal cancer in younger people has almost doubled since 1995, a steeper increase than previously recognized, according to a study from the American Cancer Society. The proportion of new diagnoses in patients younger than 55 increased from 11% to 20%. New cases of colorectal cancer rose by 2% annually among individuals younger than 50 and those 50 to 54. The incidence declined among people 65 and older, a trend that started in 2011. Rates of decline in colorectal cancer incidence and mortality slowed from 3 to 4% annually during the early 2000s to 1% for incidence and 2% for mortality in the past decade. Men had a 33% higher incidence during 2015 to 2019 from the earlier period. Advanced stage disease, which includes locally advanced and metastatic cancers, now accounts for 60% of all newly diagnosed colorectal cancer, as compared with 52% in the mid-2000s. And another story regarding young people, this from NPR. Diabetes and obesity are on the rise in young adults, a study says. Diabetes and obesity, two risk factors for heart disease, are on the rise among young adults in the U.S., according to a newly published study of about 13,000 people aged 20 to 44. The prevalence of diabetes jumped from 3% to 4%. Obesity shot up from 33% to 41%, based on the study published in the Journal of American Medical Association, which uses data from 2009 to 2020. Given the high rates of diabetes complications in the U.S., identifying and mitigating risk in younger adults could have downstream implications for cardiovascular health as well as other diabetes-related illnesses such as kidney disease, infection, and cancer, they say. Mexican-American adults faced a significant rise in diabetes and hypertension, and other Hispanic adults experienced a significant rise in hypertension as well. High sodium and ultra-processed foods, in addition to socioeconomic barriers that make it harder to access healthy foods, likely drove the rise, according to the authors. The prevalence of hypertension in young black adults was more than two times higher than in all other racial and ethnic groups, with no improvement over the study period. This can in part lead to high rates of stroke, heart failure, and hypertensive kidney disease. The study's authors pointed to structural racism as a likely root of social inequities driving the trends among black people. The authors recommended ways to address the health gaps, including pharmacist-led interventions in black barbershops, large-scale health system initiatives that screen for and treat uncontrolled blood pressure in young black adults, greater access to primary care, and more green space for regular exercise. Okay, next up, zooming out a little bit to worldwide impact of obesity. This from the World Obesity Federation. Economic impact of overweight and obesity surpassed $4 trillion by 2035. A global study predicts that more than half the global population will be living with overweight and obesity within 12 years if prevention, treatment, and support do not improve. The World Obesity Atlas 2023, published by the World Obesity Federation, predicts that the global economic impact of overweight and obesity will reach $4.3 trillion annually by 2035 if prevention and treatment measures do not improve. At almost 3% of global GDP, this is comparable with the impact of COVID-19 in 2020. The majority of the global population, 51% or over 4 billion people, will be living with either overweight or obesity by 2035 if current trends prevail. 1 in 4 people, nearly 2 billion people, will have obesity. Childhood obesity could more than double by 2035 from 2020 levels. Rates are predicted to double among boys and more than double among girls and are rising more rapidly among children than adults. Lower-income countries are facing rapid increases in obesity prevalence. Of the 10 countries with the greatest expected increases in obesity globally for both children and adults, 9 of those are from lower middle income countries. All are from either Asia or Africa. Acknowledgement of the economic impact is in no way a reflection of blame on people living with obesity, which is a chronic relapsing disease. Okay, well, as the obesity pandemic continues into the rest of the world, if you compare back to the U.S., we find that folks, foreign-born folks, actually have some health disadvantages when they move to the U.S. Might be seen as a good place to move in general, but health-wise, it's not necessarily true. This from Medical Express, getting at that. U.S.-born Hispanic people may be more vulnerable to chronic diseases than foreign-born counterparts. Compared to first-generation Hispanic people born elsewhere, those born in the U.S. showed an unfavorable blood cardiometabolic profile associated with obesity, diabetes, chronic kidney disease, and asthma, according to findings presented at the American Heart Association conference. The longer foreign-born Latinos live in the U.S., the more prone they are to developing diseases that may be related to diet, lifestyle, and environmental factors, said co-author Yang Li, a researcher at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. The difference in metabolic status between U.S.-born Latinos and U.S. and non-U.S.-born Latinos is mainly driven by westernized food, Lee said. In terms of individual risk factor, changing food patterns should be paid the first attention. The study found that Hispanic people born in the U.S. had higher levels of metabolites related to a 22% higher risk of diabetes, 16% higher risk of severe obesity, 15% higher risk of chronic kidney disease, and a 42% higher risk of asthma. Meanwhile, the metabolites that were higher in foreign-born Hispanic people were actually associated with lower risks of these diseases. What's interesting about this area of work is that it helps us to understand how the human body is sort of manifesting changes to the social environment and changes to nutrition, changes to stress, differences in social experiences between people who are staying in their home countries versus those who are in the U.S. and across generations, said Dr. Monia Jimenez, an epidemiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, an associate professor at Harvard Medical School, who was not involved in the study. Lee said his study reinforces the importance of incorporating healthy plant-based foods in Hispanic diets for optimum health. Previous research has shown that a diet rich in whole plant foods, such as vegetables, fruits, and whole grains, offers many benefits. I would add beans. What people eat is very important, and that's one of the things we can know can change quite dramatically based on the time in the U.S. and increased consumption of a westernized diet like processed foods, Jimenez said. So this study joins a long history and experience in nutritional epidemiology that people who move from native countries to the U.S. actually adopt a disease profile of the U.S., and this is true elsewhere in the world. Environment is really important. It's not necessarily where you're coming from, but who you're going to or where you're going to. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, let's switch to a series of healthcare stories here. And the good news is that there's some modest good news here. First up from Associated Press, North Carolina legislators reach Medicaid expansion deal. North Carolina legislative leaders announced last Thursday an agreement to expand Medicaid to hundreds of thousands of additional low-income adults through the Affordable Care Act. The deal, which likely won't be voted on until later this month at the earliest, marks a milestone for Republican lawmakers, most of whom opposed expansion for a decade until recently, and for hospital and patient advocates who sought it all that time. North Carolina has been one of 11 states that has not adopted Medicaid expansion. If the deal goes through, the state would start providing expansion coverage to people starting next January. Under the new agreement, senators obtained the loosening or elimination of certificate of need laws that require health regulators to sign off on plans to offer hospital beds for mental health and substance abuse patients, build ambulatory surgery centers, or purchase MRI machines. But their demand that advanced practice nurses be able to treat patients without a doctor's supervision was left out. So I'll just note that the certificate of need laws, this is a little bit geeky, but they got rid of those in Ohio in the 1990s. Pretty much allows healthcare companies to build whatever they want, buy as many MRIs as they want, build as many facilities, you know, ambulatory surgery centers, etc. And these are often the profit centers that are most competitive, so you get duplicative services because every system is trying to, you know, get those highly profitable patients. And as it turns out, you know, Ohio actually has a lot of healthcare. We just have crummy healthcare outcomes. So certificate of need is something to kind of rein in the craziest of that. So that's a compromise. So that's the bad news in this story, but the Medicaid expansion is really good news. The federal government covers 90% of the cost of Medicaid recipients under expansion. Potentially 600,000 people in North Carolina could receive the benefit. Those who make too much to qualify for conventional Medicaid, but not enough to receive heavily subsidized health insurance that Obamacare law provides. Under the agreement, the state's 10% share would be paid through assessments paid by the hospitals, which in turn benefit from getting reimbursed as they cover patients with Medicaid. Officials say the state would also get an extra $1.8 billion over 2 years through a financial sweetener in the COVID-19 federal relief package from Congress for states that hadn't accepted the expansion. So maybe that put them over the top. And the package will include provisions that could result in higher reimbursement for hospital systems when they treat Medicaid patients, resulting in at least $3.2 billion in reimbursements during the next fiscal year for traditional Medicaid patients alone. That would help rural areas where hospitals have closed or are in danger of closing. And in more Medicaid news, this from The Hill, new states have extended Medicaid coverage for new mothers. The Mississippi State Legislature moved one step closer this last week to expanding Medicaid coverage for new mothers up to a year, making it another Republican-controlled state to implement or consider the expansion. The expansion of Medicaid has been a point of contention in GOP-majority states for years. While 39 states have adopted the Medicaid expansion program that was laid out in the Affordable Care Act, a new program to extend coverage for those who recently gave birth has started to be adopted by a number of Republican states. Federal law requires states to offer pregnancy-related Medicaid coverage for eligible mothers postpartum for 60 days. Eligibility varies from state to state, ranging from 130% to 380% of the federal poverty level. The law also requires that states offer a more narrow set of pregnancy-related coverage rather than full Medicaid coverage. But the American Rescue Plan, a $1.9 trillion spending package signed by President Biden in 2021 amid the throes of the COVID-19 pandemic, offered states the opportunity to extend Medicaid postpartum coverage for up to a year after birth, which would include full Medicaid coverage. And as federal abortion protections fall, a number of Republican states have chosen to extend the Medicaid postpartum coverage for a full year, while some lawmakers framing it as a new quote, pro-life policy platform. It's nice to see a small mark of that. There have been 28 states that have adopted or implemented the limited Medicaid postpartum coverage extensions thus far. There are 7 states that are planning to implement the full Medicaid expansion, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. 9 states, all of which either have a Republican governor or state legislature, have not adopted even the limited postpartum expansion. Next up, a story that touches on the growing divide between rural and urban areas. This is from the New York Times. Rural hospitals are shuttering their maternity units. From 2015 to 2019, there were at least 89 obstetric unit closures in rural hospitals across the country. By 2020, about half of rural community hospitals did not provide obstetrics care, according to the American Hospital Association. In the past year, the closures appear to have accelerated, as hospitals from Maine to California have jettisoned maternity units, mostly in rural areas where the population has dwindled and the number of births has declined. A study of hospital administrators carried out before the pandemic found that 20% of them said they did not expect to be providing labor and delivery services in 5 years' time. Women in rural areas face a higher risk of pregnancy-related complications, according to a study by the Commonwealth Fund. Those living in so-called maternity care deserts are 3 times as likely to die during pregnancy and the critical year afterwards as those who are closer to care, according to a study of mothers in Louisiana. The United States is already the most dangerous developed country in the world for women giving birth. Recent figures show that the problems are particularly acute in minority communities and especially among Native American women, whose risk of dying of pregnancy-related complications is 3 times as high as that of white women. Their babies are almost twice as likely to die during the first year of life as white babies. Women of color are more likely to live in maternity care deserts or in communities with limited access or care. According to the March of Dimes, the maternal health nonprofit, 7 million women of childbearing age reside in counties where there is no hospital-based obstetric care, no birthing center, no OB-GYN, and no certified nurse midwife, or where access to those services is limited. Fewer than half of women in rural areas can find perinatal care within 30 miles, according to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. The closure of an obstetrics unit often begins a downward health spiral in remote communities, without ready access to obstetricians, prenatal care, and critical postpartum checkups. Risky complications become more likely. Well, that sounds like a good reason to get health care for all, with everybody in and nobody out, assuring health care regardless of where you live.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, let's close out the series of healthcare stories with one that sort of typifies where we're at with American healthcare. Yikes, for-profit healthcare doesn't work for us very well. This from CBS News. Weight loss drug coming to the UK market, and it will cost a fraction of what Americans pay. The list price in the UK is about $88, but in the US, the list price is $1,349. You gotta wonder why we have such a huge difference if the free market is supposed to provide healthcare at the lowest cost possible with so-called competition. We don't seem to be doing a very good job. Okay, well, next up, we have a story that offers a fresh perspective on eating disorders. This from the Detroit News. MSU research puts a new face on who is at risk for eating disorders. A new study is adding to myth-busting research about who is prone to developing eating disorder. Researchers at Michigan State University found that children living in disadvantaged circumstances are at elevated risk for developing disordered eating, especially if they have underlying genetic risk. The work reveals that young boys from disadvantaged backgrounds may be the surprising and often silent victims of a mental illness which, since the pandemic, appears to be on the rise. What our data really suggests is that eating disorders affect everybody, and in fact, there may be increased risk for these disorders in individuals who are facing significant economic challenges, said Kelly Klump, an MSU professor of psychology. In this most recent study, researchers in Klump's lab looked at more than 3,400 boys enrolled in the Michigan State University's Twin Registry. A previous study focused on girls. The researchers measured disadvantage by evaluating family income, the percentage of children who qualify for free lunch, and other neighborhood-level factors. We have research showing that living in a disadvantaged circumstance increases your risk for anxiety and depression, and also more conduct and behavioral concerns, said Megan McHale, a PhD student and first author of the paper documenting the findings. But the same research questions had not been put to eating disorders until now. Approximately 29 million Americans will or have an eating disorder in their lifetime, and 2 million of these new cases will occur in children and adolescents, according to 2020 research by Deloitte. These rates translate into thousands upon thousands of premature deaths. In fact, among mental illnesses, eating disorders are second only to opioid addiction in their deadliness, costing more than 10,000 lives each year. Eating disorders have really skyrocketed during the pandemic, said Dr. Jason Nagata, professor of pediatrics at the University of California, San Francisco, and an expert on eating disorders in boys and men. I do think that some of this is sort of a remnant of the pandemic crisis that has really trickled into the youth mental health crisis in very complex ways. Boys with these illnesses may engage in weight loss behaviors commonly associated with eating disorders, fasting or skipping meals, severely restricting food intake, vomiting or using diuretics or laxatives. Like girls, they can become preoccupied with their appearance, body size, weight, or food in a way that worsens their quality of life. But many boys with eating disorders engage in muscle-building behaviors, over-consuming protein while restricting carbohydrates and fat, taking anabolic steroids or other drugs and supplements in an effort to build up, bulk up, or engage in excessive or compulsive exercise. Most people don't think about disadvantaged boys when they think about eating disorders. These illnesses are perceived to be an infliction of what University of Michigan professor Kendrin Sunneville terms SWAGs, skinny white affluent girls. Sunneville, who spent 12 years in clinical practice treating children with eating disorders and now conducts public health research out of her lab for eating disorder prevention, says the misconception persist because swags are more likely to get diagnosed and treated. That's skinny white affluent girls. Multiple studies have found that ethnic minorities are far less likely to seek and receive treatment for eating disorders. People of color are significantly less likely than white people to have been asked by a doctor about eating disorder symptoms, according to the National Association of Anorexia Nervosa and Associated Disorders. If you meet the stereotype, you're getting help. If you don't, you're not getting recognized. There are a lot of misconceptions in this field that serve to disadvantage the disadvantage. People who don't fit the mental image of an eating disorder victim are less likely to receive a diagnosis from a mental health care professional, even if they meet the criteria for one. They might not be screened for an eating disorder, or their symptoms could be misinterpreted. Females are almost 5 times more likely than males to be diagnosed with an eating disorder, and 1.5 times more likely to receive treatment, according to research conducted on college-age students at the University of Michigan. Nagata points out that screening tools have been designed to pick out young women who are obsessed with becoming thinner, not boys who are overly restrictive or compulsive in the ways they try to get bigger. Nagata treats about 1/6 as many boys as girls, but he says the young men he cares for show up with more severe eating disorders. They have often gone undiagnosed for longer. I do think that there are many boys and men who are struggling who just never get diagnosed or identified, he said. When minorities and boys do receive treatment, chances are it was not developed with them in mind. A vast majority of the research, a vast majority of the treatment programs were only designed based on female samples, Nagata said. And so there are many treatment centers who actually don't accept boys because they don't know what to do with them. While no one policy or one program could prevent all eating disorders, Sunneville says certain population level approaches might help. Limiting children's exposure to social media, holding companies to a stricter standard when it comes to advertising diet-related products, working with schools to teach greater media literacy and boost adolescent self-esteem, and banning the sale of weight loss and weight control products to kids younger than 18. With growing evidence that disadvantage can heighten the risk for eating disorders, policies that prevent food insecurity, safeguard children against neglect, abuse, and trauma, and keep them feeling safe in their bodies can all be strategies for prevention. Okay, well, I'd like to close out the regular reporting in this episode about a story about diet and our carbon footprints. This is from Medical Express. Keto versus vegan. Study of popular diets finds over fourfold difference in carbon footprints. For those on keto or paleo diets, this may be tough to swallow. A new study from Tulane University that compared popular diets on both nutritional quality and environmental impact found that the keto and paleo diet, as eaten by American adults, scored among the lowest on overall nutrition quality and were among the highest on carbon emissions. The keto diet, which prioritizes high amounts of fat and low amounts of carbs, was estimated to generate almost 3 kilograms of carbon dioxide for every 1,000 calories consumed. The paleo diet, which eschews grains and beans in favor of meats, nuts, and vegetables, received the next lowest diet quality score and also had a high carbon footprint at 2.6 kilograms of carbon dioxide per 1,000 calories. We suspected the negative climate impacts because they're meat-centric, but no one had really compared all these diets as they were chosen by individuals instead of as prescribed by experts to each other using a common framework. On the other end of the spectrum, a vegan diet was found to be the least impactful on climate, generating 0.7 kilograms of carbon dioxide per 1,000 calories, less than a quarter of the impact of the keto diet. The vegan diet was followed by vegetarian and pescatarian diets in an increasing impact on the environment. The omnivore diet, the most common diet, represented by 86% of survey participants, sat squarely in the middle of the pack of both quality and sustainability. Based on the findings, if a third of those on omnivore diets began eating a vegetarian diet, on average for any given day, it would be equivalent to eliminating 340 million passenger vehicle miles. Or another way, just say if those who were on omnivore diet switched to a vegetarian diet, it would be over 1 billion passenger miles, and that's like four passenger vehicle miles per person in the country. A 2021 United Nations-backed study found that 34% of greenhouse gas emissions come from the food system. The major share of those emissions come from food production, with beef being responsible for 8 to 10 times more emissions than chicken production, and over 20 times more emissions than nut and legume production. I think the next question is how would different policies affect outcomes, and how could those move us towards healthier, more environmentally friendly diets? Okay, well, that brings us to the last segment of the show. Bonus article, bum, 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 bum. A carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give the link at the end of the list. This week, we have 23 bonus articles. First up, activist Judy Heumann led a reimagining of what it means to be disabled. And I'll sum up, this is a beautiful article. She died recently, and it's sort of an obituary, but has a long career of being a disability advocate, and this quote sort of sums it up. Disability only becomes a tragedy when society fails to provide the things we need to lead our lives, job opportunities, or barrier-free buildings. For example, it is not a tragedy to me that I'm living in a wheelchair. So there you go. I suggest reading that full article to get a retrospective on the life of a wonderful activist. Bonus article 2. The next deadly pandemic is just a forest clearing away, but we're not even trying to prevent it. So this is areas in the world where people are moving into the edge of the forest, and they're basically surrounding themselves in the forest. So you've got this dense forest interspersed with people, and it's one of the worst for transmission between wild animals and humans as far as viruses. This is happening around the world in various places. And another climate change related story, bonus article 3, is climate change good for insurgent groups? Well, the short answer is yes. Basically, when you have the instability created by climate change, it benefits the rise of insurgent groups. Bonus article 4, Department of Health and Human Services Environmental Justice Index institutionalized climate apartheid. This is an interesting story. I generally think that this Environmental Justice Index is a move forward, but this does strike at some very basic limitations, and one that's very serious to consider. And I think the whole idea of talking about institutionalizing a climate apartheid is that one of the real dark sides of this is that when you identify these areas that are at great risk, it might actually lead to some areas that are kind of written off as sacrifice zones. And those, so rather than helping the people who are living these places that are potentially sacrifice zones, we might just sacrifice them. Not like that's ever happened before. Bonus article 5. Guns are the biggest public health threats kids face. Why aren't they getting the message? So this is a good article getting at basically there have been campaigns before, like with tobacco, that try to change the social norms. And one around guns, particularly with kids, is ripe for the picking. Let's do it. Bonus article 6. Documents deal EMT's failure to aid Tyree Nichols, beaten to death by police. So he was unaided for 19 minutes, even though he showed very visible signs of distress. They were fired. I'm not sure what other consequences, but yikes. Healthcare workers should not aid and abet torture. Bonus article 7. After people on Medicaid die, some states aggressively seek repayment from their estates. I had never actually heard this before, and this is fascinating. The federal government actually requires that states try to get repayment from estates from people on Medicaid that die. This is particularly geared towards people in nursing homes or home health care, but actually it can be anybody, and for almost any asset under any circumstance. It's kind of crazy, and actual Ohio laws are some of the worst regarding this, about who and how they can go after people. And I think it's just it's an example of really missing the boat, because you've already got people that, you know, are on the edge of indigency in many cases, but then you're actually grinding people into the ground where you can't even have any transfer of generational wealth on the low income end of the spectrum. Doesn't seem to be a particularly good use of our time. And, you know, just after people die is probably not the best time to have a governmental intervention to take away take away money. Yep, and if you thought that family home was safe in life, it's not necessarily safe in death. Bonus article 8. For-profit hospices deliver lower quality care than non-profit hospices. So for-profit hospices now account for over 70% of all hospice services. So, and that's a big change over recent years and decades. And once again, for-profit organizations prove to deliver worse quality care and actually at higher cost. Bonus Article 9. Walgreens won't distribute abortion pills in states where GOP attorney generals object. They've been very aggressive in hounding pharmacy chain CEOs, threatening prosecution, and Walgreens, and, you know, great show of courage, although the expectations are pretty low among, you know, corporate CEOs. But they're going to provide different services in different states, depends on which AGs are staring you down. And it's just another example how all these abortion laws are really putting in peril and throwing up into the air the uncertainty around prosecution, around a whole bunch of actions of providing health care for people that need abortions. Bonus Article 10, Eli Lilly slash insulin prices. This starts a race to the bottom. And this one, actually, the bottom doesn't mean the bottom morally or amorally, but it actually means the bottom of prices. So this is a good story that Eli Lilly, which has a lot of market share, is looking ahead, and it knows there's been a lot of efforts in recent years to, you know, California is going to start producing its own insulin, for instance. I reported on that before. They see it coming, that prices are going to go down, and they don't want to lose market share. So they're at least getting out ahead to try to reduce insulin prices before the rest of the pack does, and maybe they can gain or maintain their market share. And these other initiatives that are to produce insulin are still fine and not threatened by that. Bonus Article 11, bailed out by taxpayers. Data shows big insurance profiting massively from Medicare privatization. So the big seven insurance companies that account for over 70% of Medicare Advantage plans are making a ton of money off Medicare Advantage plans, which are reported widely on before. And a similar one, Bonus Article 12, brokers get lush trips and cash perks to sell costly Medigap plans. So these are the supplemental plans that people on Medicare are sold to cover the gaps in traditional Medicare. And many millions of Americans get those. And as I've reported with Medicaid Advantage, insurance brokers have a lot of incentives. In this case, brokers getting lush trips and cash perks to sell the most expensive and costly, profitable Medigap plans. Again, for-profit healthcare, giving you something that's worth less for more. Bonus Article 13. A Maryland experiment in global budgeting shows a better way to reduce healthcare spending. So this is a little bit geeky, global budgeting, but basically what it does is it puts everybody in and nobody out in the entire state, in this case Maryland, and it actually allows the ability to get focusing on healthcare rather than on generating revenue, which is good for both controlling costs and providing better healthcare. And this is similar to what would happen if you had a national health program, universal healthcare. Bonus Article 14, FTC finds BetterHelp $7.8 million, alleges it shares consumer mental health info with its advertisers. So I've reported on this before, and it's a growing problem with in the whole data world, is that people's health information is not necessarily well protected, I mean, used for marketing and for-profit purposes. Bonus Article 15, how physician wellness programs blame doctors and overlook systems illness. You know, it's a classical example of, you know, the system trying to shift the focus on the people who are suffering the problems, a poor wellness of doctors in this case, when actually it's the system itself that's sick and producing the wellness, the lack of wellness in doctors. Article 16, despite pharma claims, illicit drug shipments to U.S. aren't full of opioids, it's generic Viagra. So this is just an interesting kind of political take, that there are a lot of non-FDA-authorized, you know, mimics and generics and all that kind of stuff. They may even be produced in the same factory that are producing the ones that are FDA-approved, but if they don't have the proper labeling and all that kind of stuff, you know, they're interdicted. And politically, it's popular to say that, you know, it's a bunch of opioids coming across, but usually it's a bunch of other drugs, and generic Viagra happens to be the number one, one that's seized. Article 17, organ donation cartel is a failure. I've reported on this one before, that organ donation and transplantation system which is basically coordinated by one group called a cartel previously, is not working well at all. And this just details that in more detail than I even reported on before. Bonus article 18, population-wide gene testing has limited ability to predict disease. So genetic testing is becoming more and more popular among the populace. But actually, if you're looking at just the average person getting these tests that give you, you know, risk scores about different diseases and stuff, most of those things will not capture most of the disease that happens in most of the people. You kind of parse that out a bit. Basically, from a public health point of view, from a screening kind of point of view, it's really not that useful. And next up in Article 18, sort of a product warning, erythritol, an artificial sweetener, may increase heart attack risk. So this is a preliminary study. Typically, I would say with artificial sweeteners, you know, they're probably not much worse than sugar. So I don't know how much of a big deal, but this one definitely, erythritol, which is popular like in low sugar ice creams and other things, is probably something that's worth avoiding. Article 20, how common is transgender treatment regret and detransitioning? Likely rare, and we're probably talking something in the order of 1% or so. Article 21, why human touch matters in healthcare, the limitations of AI. So this is kind of a companion piece of the three that I reported on earlier in the show and talks about 10 different areas where AI has significant limitations in providing good healthcare. Article 22, the little known physical and mental health benefits of urban trees. So this is a good overview article of the fact that trees in the city are very good for both our mental and physical health. I would give a little caveat that a lot of the effect sizes that are reported in this article might be overstated a bit. And, you know, it's an evolving science, and as that develops, it'll probably become more accurate. I think it's safe to say that trees are good for us. Plant more trees, my friends. And 23, last but not least, are you considering a complementary health approach? Here's just some guidance on what to look for in working out your complementary health care. You can get these and all the other stories I've reported on this show by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Again, that's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.